First of all, I'd like to thank the Manhattan Medrash for this opportunity to share a few Torah ideas with you. Also to thank our sponsor for this evening, kindly supporting this activity. The suggestion was that we talk about the subject of happiness, or happiness in a sad world, the challenge of the problem or the challenge of happiness from a Jewish perspective, from a Torah perspective, very difficult subject. Let's see if we can put our heads into the deeper level here and understand something a little different. First of all, let's ask a few questions. Is it an obligation to be happy? From a Jewish perspective, is it an obligation, is it a mitzvah to be happy? Question number one. If it is a mitzvah, you will not find that documented in the list of the mitzvahs. If you go through all the commandments, all 613 commandments, you will not find thou shalt be happy. You won't find a mitzvah like that. On the other hand, there are statements in Torah literature, in text, scriptural text, that make it apparent that it's an obligation to be happy. For example, it says, Ivdus Hashem b'simcha, serve God, serve Hashem with joy. That is clearly an injunction obliging you to generate this sense of happiness, you would see. And the technical question here is, what's the nature of a Jewish obligation that's not a mitzvah? If it's an obligation, then in which mitzvah is it contained? Again, why is it not formalized as a commandment if you're obliged to do it? What's the sense of an obligation that's not a mitzvah? Do you hear the problem? Anyone out there? Doubtful, huh? Try again. There are 613 commandments in the Torah. They cover the whole spectrum of spiritual obligations. None of them include being happy. But there are other texts that are not formalized as commandments that make it apparent that it's an obligation to be happy. There's a conflict there, there's a challenge. Let's go a little further. There are paradoxical statements within Torah, within Scripture, that concern happiness. For example, when the Torah mentions the curses that the Jewish people will experience if we defect from our obligations, the Torah goes through 98 or 99 or 100 Holocaust-type curses, predictions that the Jewish people will experience, all of which we have lived through over the centuries, and then the Torah gives what purports to be a reason. Why will you suffer these indescribable tortures throughout history? Because you did not serve God with joy. That begs any understanding. The reason that we suffered what we suffered historically is because we weren't happy enough? What does that mean? Furthermore, those sources that indicate that it's an obligation to be happy indicate that it's an obligation to be happy at all times. So how is that possible? For example, we have a folk saying, Ivdus Hashem b'simcha. Excuse me. Mitzvah gedol elias b'simcha tamid. It's a great mitzvah to be happy always, whatever mitzvah means. How can you be happy always? What does it mean always? What about the obligation of sitting on the floor in the act of mourning for someone who died? That for sure is an obligation. Whether you have to cry or not cry is debatable. But you have to rip your clothes and sit on the floor in mourning. How can you say it's a mitzvah to be enjoy always? We don't have approximate statements or exaggerations or inaccuracies in Torah or in the words of the sages. What does that mean? Furthermore, there's a letter of the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish was the great Torah sage of the last generation, died in 1953. In one of his letters, he makes the following statement. Someone must have written to him with his personal difficulties. Not sure what the question was. But in his answer, he says the following. It's worth looking up yourself. He says, the Mishe Makir is Eira Erishalayim. Very hard to translate in English. He said, for somebody who knows the light of truth, I guess the loose translation would be, for someone who knows what life's all about, Ein etzev ba'olam, there's no sadness in the world. How can a person say that? How can a sage make a statement like that? What do you mean there's no sadness? Ein etzev ba'olam, there's no sadness in the world. What could that mean? The Chazon Ish lived through the tragedy of 60 years ago that befell the Jewish people. He had his own personal tragedy. He had the weight of suffering of the Jewish people on his shoulders. How can a person say Ein etzev ba'olam? What does that mean? He forgot about sitting on the floor and weeping and mourning for someone who died. What does that mean? And furthermore, If it's an obligation to be happy, how do you do that in a world full of brutality? In case you hadn't noticed. I don't know, maybe here in Manhattan people are perfect. I don't know. But if you look around you, you'll see the world has a burden of suffering, of indescribable torture and torment, most of it unnecessary. How do you generate happiness in a world like that? How does the non-Jewish world handle it? By one or other form of dissociation, drunkenness, technical, emotional, chemical. How do you enter a state of happiness when there's suffering around you? Take yourself out of it. But Judaism is a pathway of superconscious awareness. It's not a pathway of dissociation, unawareness. So how are you going to generate happiness? What are you going to do? Go out with a few friends and have a meal, a few drinks maybe, and have a laugh? How can you do that with other people? Is anyone sitting in this room who does not know someone or have someone directly connected to with their family who's not suffering some indescribable form of suffering, whether it's marital or medical or financial or... No? Anyone? Nobody? You're not aware of anybody?
No.
Spend a little time with me, I'll take you through a few.
When you say you suffer through it, doesn't mean that you don't have the problem.
Stay with me. Let's try and work it out together. You have two options. You will either dissociate yourself, you'll enjoy yourself and have a good time because you'll forget the suffering around you. That's a very insensitive thing to do. Or you'll tell me no, what you'll do is you'll bear with you the consciousness of the suffering and you'll have a good time anyway. That's even more insensitive. So how do you go out and dissociate and have a good time and enjoy yourself when you're aware of who must be?
People.
What?
You put yourself in positive people.
So you forget those who suffer.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But that's not what Judaism requires. There's a tremendous insensitivity in doing that.
Yeah.
If you're a sensitive person, you're aware of what human suffering means. How can you do that? Now, let's try and work it out slowly.
How much suffering would be enough?
Enough to do what? To bother you? Strictly speaking, anything. One child being tortured, yeah, should give you sleepless nights the rest of your life. You don't have a giggle and entertainment and go have some fun. Do you know what's going on in the world? Do you know how many people are, do you know that the genocides are continuing in the last few years that have been reported in a line in the newspaper? There were times when Lake Tanganyika was floating with bodies. When 10,000 people were killed by the Hutus, you're not even meriting a line in the newspaper, not even a headline. There were times when you couldn't drink the fish. You couldn't eat the fish because of the contamination of human body. You know what? So what, are you going to go to a movie? You're going to go to a movie, have a pizza and a giggle and a... So there's a problem here, there's a challenge here. What is the meaning of this? What is the Jewish obligation of happiness? And if there is such an obligation, then how does it conquer the obligation of mourning, for example? How do you put those two together? How do you generate the happiness that you're meant to generate in the face of suffering? And furthermore, what happens when you're suffering? Not some child that you don't know in Africa. What happens when you go through your own almost unbearable suffering? And there's an obligation to endure. What does that mean? How do you put those together? Let's try to work through it. It's a very deep subject, not an easy subject at all. It requires a different approach, different wavelength. Let's try and make an effort together. Let me suggest to you a much more mature definition of happiness than dissociation or forgetfulness. And let's try to understand why this is correct, and let's try to think it through together and flesh it out. The correct definition of happiness is this, what we call simcha, that expansion of consciousness. That we call simcha is defined as follows. It's nothing to do with dissociation, drunkenness, empty laughter, even though that may be the most current in the world around us. You know that our Kabbalistic teaching is that the world has now reached the stage of what's called the thick skin on the bottom of the feet. You know that we have a teaching that every generation is a lower generation than the previous one. And the pre-messianic generation, which is ours, is considered to be the bottom of the feet. The expression in the Talmud is Ikfas of the Mashiach. Technically, that is translated, usually translated as the footfalls of the Mashiach. You can hear the messianic footfalls, as it were. You can hear his footsteps. But the Kabbalistic translation is that it means the thick skin on the bottom of the heels of the human form. Previous generations of human history were higher. And as history progresses, we move through the layers. And eventually in the pre-messianic age, which is ours, we reach the bottom of the feet. The meaning of the heels in Kabbalistic thinking is that part of the human body where death is invested. The reason you die, mystically speaking, is because you're born with death already within your frame. If you had no death within you, you could not die. Life cannot die. You die only because you're born with a point of your body in which death already has a hold, and that's the heel. That's the deep meaning of the serpent who bites the heel. He will bruise his head and he will bite your heel. The original sin puts poison, the poison of death, into the human body, and it puts it into the heel. The Gemara says that after death, the heels do not rot. Ein rekev ba'ake. The heels do not rot after death because they are already not alive, even in life. Incidentally, this is why. Where do you think in their mythology they came up with a notion of the invulnerability of a body except for the heel? All of the world's mythology is based on original Torah sources. It's quite correct. That's the point of vulnerability where death has a hold. And that's the bottom of the thick skin. And in the human anatomy, the thick skin on the bottom of the heels is completely insensitive. You can stick pins. I had a friend when I was young, he used to put his cigarettes out in the soles of his feet. Because they're completely insensitive. What's unique about I can tell you as a doctor, I can assure you, as a physician, one of the great mysteries of anatomy is that the bottom of the feet are totally insensitive to anything real. You can stick pins in, you can cut them, they're not sensitive. But if you stimulate them superficially, you draw a feather over the soles of the feet, exquisitely sensitive. And the result is laughter. And there are Kabbalistic thinkers who say that that's the definition of our generation. Completely insensitive to genuine torture and suffering, but available for superficial stimulation that results in empty loss. That's the notion. But we're not talking about that. The real laughter, the real spiritual joy, has got nothing to do with drunkenness or unawareness. The correct definition of happiness is it's the response of the soul to doing what it should be doing. When you are doing what you should be doing, then the neshama, the soul, responds with joy. When you're moving along the correct road to a correct destination against resistance and you're making progress, there's an inner sense of expansion that is called simcha. And the expression on the face is irrelevant. In fact, I'll try to demonstrate that the expression on the face is some of the times in life when the expression on the face is the most problematic, pouring with sweat and contorted in effort, when some of the deepest joy of life can be felt. Again, when you're doing what you need to be doing and you're moving towards the correct destination and you're moving correctly against resistance and making progress, there's an inner sense of expansion that is genuine joy. Being that I don't see many convinced faces, let's try to establish this. There's a very deep idea here. Imagine you have to build something very significant, right? You have to work in the hot sun and you have to carry logs and rocks and you have to build something that's very significant, extremely significant, and you have a time limit. Okay? You start laboring hour after hour, and after a number of hours have gone by, you notice that if you continue at this rate, you will be finished in time. What emotion surges through you at that point? There's no question that although your face is streaked with sweat and your body's contorted with exertion, there's no question that there's a surge of joy that runs through you as you see you're going to make your goal. Right? Because in the work itself, in the productive work itself, is a tremendous joy. Now, that being that I still don't see enough convinced faces, let me try again. You're a Martian. You come from Mars? You're a Martian. You want to know what humanity is all about. So you hire an Earth guide to take you on a tour of the human race. The first place the fellow takes you is a gymnasium. A gym. One of those establishments in which young men spend hours every day trying to approximate the good looks of a gorilla. So he takes you to this place and you look through the keyhole and then you see this young fellow working on a machine. He's stretching springs and he's picking up weights and he's moving this thing. His body's racked with tremors of exertion. He's ashen in color. He's pouring with sweat. Right? He looks close to collapse. And you would conclude that just out of your range of vision must be another Earth being with a machine gun forcing him to do this bizarre form of torture, wouldn't you? Would that not be the logical conclusion? Of course it would. But if you step into the room, you'll find there's no one forcing him. He's paying for this privilege. He's paying to be allowed to do this, and he's loving every moment. As you analyze it deeply, you'll find that what he's loving is the pain itself. And the pain of that kind of exertion can be so intense it can become addictive. And that's very peculiar. Why are we created in such a way Why are we built in such a way? What's the meaning of this? Why is the human soul constructed in such a way that when you exert yourself against resistance and you make progress, you enjoy that exercise? Why? Why is it when you undertake a journey, a march, a hike, to a meaningful destination, and you long to step off into the arms of the destination, and as you move on that journey, the journey itself is a tremendous thrill. Why should the journey be a thrill? When it's difficult. Why is it when you work creatively to solve a problem, you have to solve a professional problem or an aesthetic problem, you have a day, an hour, a day, or a week, whatever it is, and you exert yourself tremendously to produce that beautiful thing. Why is it that you enjoy the effort of producing that, enjoy grappling with the problems and solving them and overcoming them? Why do you enjoy the exertion? So let's go through this. It's an amazing subject. Deep mystical subject. If you examine the subject, you'll find, let's try and go in layers here and prove each step. You'll find that the reason you enjoy a journey to a meaningful destination is entirely because of the anticipation of the destination. When you're climbing that mountain, right? Yes, it's the sense of moving towards the conquest, moving towards the ultimate achievement of that difficult and challenging goal that keeps you going, and it informs the joy of every moment. When you're going on a difficult journey, every mile you travel on that journey has its pleasure, because each mile is a richer anticipation of the destination. In fact, the anticipation is often better than getting there. It's often worth not arriving, because it's often a big disappointment. But the anticipation of the destination, the sense of destination, is what gives joy to every moment of the journey. And then there's a paradox. First of all, can we prove that? I think we can. Imagine you're building the structure that you're laboring to build. And as you enjoy the thrill of putting all the pieces together and you're near completion, you suddenly become informed that one moment before it's completed will be destroyed. What happens to the sense of achievement and joy that previously pervaded you? It becomes pure torture now. Because you're not enjoying the difficulty, you're enjoying the fact that the difficulty leads to the result. What happens if you're going on a difficult journey towards a destination that you're longing for, and you're enjoying the cadence and the rhythm of the journey, and suddenly you become informed you're on the wrong train? No more pleasure in the journey. Pure torture. The reason the climb or the march is pleasurable is because every step is a more tangible realization of the destination. And these words are very clumsy. Yeah, what we're doing here is appealing to a sense of life and an experience that all of us have. The next step provides a paradox. Why is it when you get to the destination that you relish the joy of the destination? When you stand on that mountaintop that you spent all this time and effort and risk to climb, what is the nature, what is the sensation of the joy that you experience at that time? You'll find paradoxically, it's not the experience itself, it's knowing how difficult the journey was that got you here. You don't enjoy the simple aesthetic. Yep. That's why the Gemara says, the Talmud says, you'd rather have one thing you do yourself than nine that you're given for free. Because there's a special joy in the fact that you constructed it yourself. When you have to solve a problem, you have an aesthetic challenge, you have to build something beautiful, and you labor for an hour, for a week, and you solve the problem, and finally you have this result that you've created. It's not just appreciation of the beauty of the thing, it's the fact that you did that. And the more difficult and arduous and seemingly impossible it was to get there, the more the pleasure is in the destination, in the result. So you have here a peculiar paradox. The reason the journey is pleasurable towards the destination is because you're anticipating getting there. And when you get there, what you enjoy is how hard it was. Hear what's going on? It's an amazing thing. There's a circle here that doesn't seem to have an absolute point of origin. What's the meaning of it? Give me a second. I'm having enough trouble with me right now. Give me a few minutes. Let me just build this picture and I'll stop for questions of pleasure. Why are we designed in such a way? Why are we built in such a way that we enjoy the exertion that leads to a result, and when we get to the result, we enjoy the knowledge of how difficult the exertion was? We have here a spiritual axiom which needs to be clarified. And the principle is like this. There's a general Kabbalistic principle that everything in the physical world is a manifestation of something in the spiritual root. Everything in the spiritual root is manifest in a physical experience or phenomenon or object in the world, and every object in the world or experience is a reflection, a projection of something in the root. And the reason that it's built that way, the reason that reality is constructed that way, is because the purpose of life is not to be engaged and invested in the physical. The purpose of life is to engage, to live in the physical and reach up into a transcendent experience. The reason we are here is to make contact with that which is above. The problem is, we have no faculty or sense organ that can contact, that can directly apprehend that which is above. And therefore, the way the world's constructed is, that everything you're meant to understand in the higher world, you're given a tangible version of in this world. Are we together? The principle is that everything you experience here is not only meant to be an immediate experience, it's also meant to teach you about something in the higher world. And if you understand it correctly, you can understand that thing. Let's take an example. Take a trivial example. Whatever you care to say, people get homesick. People long for the place they come from. Everyone says, "Chena makam al yoshva." People have a special, the place you come from has special beauty in your eyes, even if it's not particularly beautiful. Why are we built in such a way that we long for home? So if you're brought up in the secular culture, they teach you it's because a few million years ago when you were a pigeon, you know, you needed this faculty in order to find your way home. That's not a Jewish way of thinking. A Jewish way of thinking is, what's the spiritual meaning of this? And the spiritual meaning is that your soul, your neshama, comes from a very high place, that is its genuine home. And there's always the most intense longing to be back there. And that's translated into the superficial world of the emotions as a longing to go back to your home, to the place you come from. Incidentally, what do people at home do? They long to travel. They long to travel for them. And that's also because the neshama, the soul, longs to move to the world and experience its beauty and its opportunities. People like to buy things. Whatever you care. People like to buy things. People like to think about buying things. People like to go look at the things that they buy if they could, even though they can't. Why? Because the soul longs to move through the world and acquire the genuine goods of Torah and mitzvahs, of spirituality, of genuine achievements and acquisition, that bond with the essence of the soul. And that's translated into physical experience as wanting things. But the general principle is that everything that you are meant to contact in the higher world, you're given an example that you can contact directly in the physical world, and from that you can extrapolate. Let me take a difficult example, the final example. Let's take one of the hardest, probably impossible. There's a thing called dvekus. Dvekus means the obligation of bonding the soul into the Creator. That means there's a meditation that is so deep, a work that is so deep, that it takes the neshama, the soul consciousness, and bonds it into that of the source. So intensely that you become one. And the paradox is that in losing your ego entirely, completely divesting yourself of ego, and bonding with the source, paradoxically, for the first time, you discover who you are as an individual. Now, that's the paradox. Then you see yourself clearly. And what do you do with your newfound sense of who you actually are? You put that right back into bonding with the source again. Now, that's the paradox. How on earth are you begin to explore? Are you meant to understand and explore such a phenomenon? How are you meant to begin this process of giving yourself up so that you bond into an ultimate reality and thereby discover who you are? And the answer is marriage. You know what marriage is supposed to be? You know what Jewish marriage is supposed to be? Again, our sources say that men will find this impossible. Men will find this impossible. Women understand this naturally. Men find it impossible. Well, I'm just telling you what's written. Okay, that's what it says. The reason men find it difficult is because men naturally are bonded to their egos. And therefore, to give up the ego entirely with complete vulnerability is a very difficult thing for the male, in the male mode. But nevertheless, that's the idea. The idea is like this. Marriage is supposed to be two people giving themselves to each other with complete fearlessness, ultimate giving, with complete vulnerability, such that the two bond into one thing. The one thing that has been formed is greater than the sum of the parts. But it's only done by losing yourself entirely, nothing withheld at all. When the two become one, the paradox is that each individual in that relationship discovers who he is or she is as an independent individual. And what you do with that newfound discovery of sense of individuality is you put it right back in. And marriage is supposed to be a nuclear reaction of this intensity of two becoming one, which paradoxically informs your own individuality. That's a lost art. It's a lost art, largely because men have lost it. Women are still more, at least have a vestige of connection to source in this generation. But that's what it's meant to be. There's a very difficult thing. In fact, the Hebrew word for love, the Torah word for love means giving. The Hebrew word ahava is based on hav, which means to give. The modern world thinks you love what you get. If someone makes you feel good, you love them. If someone makes you feel good, you don't love them, you love you. It's like saying, I love fish. You don't love fish. You grill it and eat it. If you really loved the fish, you would gently put it back in the water and let it swim back to its mom. That's not called love. Real love is giving of the self. Love is generated where you give. That's why the parents always love the children more than the children love the parents. Parents always love the children more than the children love the parents, because the giving goes in that direction. You love where you give, but you love intensely where you give of self. You give yourself. You know that you can never love anyone other than yourself. Just as you can never intrinsically know anyone other than yourself, you can never genuinely love anyone other than yourself. How love of another is constructed is by giving yourself so intensely into that other that you become one being. Then there's no problem of love. Love is not that I love you as other and distinct. It means I invest myself in you so intensely that we are one. Then of course there's a love. The Hebrew word ahava, love, adds up to the same numerical equivalent as the word echad, meaning one. That's another example. And the world is full of these examples. All experiences that we can have, our teachings, are reflections of the source. Let's go back to our question about happiness. Our observation is that when you move towards a destination, you build a project, take a journey to a destination, there's a thrill in the journey, which is derived from sense of moving towards destination. There's a thrill in destination of knowing how arduous the journey was. What does that reflect in the higher world? Do you hear the question? And the answer is life itself. Because our concept of life is that it's a very difficult journey against resistance to an end point which is a destination which is nothing other than what the life itself has generated. Our concept of life, the words we use for this are Eretz and Shamayim. In the non-Jewish ear, that means in the unschooled ear, from a Jewish point of view, those words mean heaven and earth. But in Hebrew, Eretz and Shamayim does not mean heaven and earth. Eretz, meaning earth, technically, is derived from the word meaning to run towards. Eretz means, earth means a running towards. And Shamayim in Hebrew means all the conglomerate destinations that could ever be put together. The word Shamayim is, in Hebrew, Shammim. All the end points that you can define. Sham in Hebrew is always the word meaning destination or essence. For example, Sham means there. Sham in Hebrew is also the word Shem, meaning a name, which is always a description of essence. Sham is the root of the word Neshama, the soul, which is a description of essence. Shamayim means where all the end point destinations of life exist. Our notion of life is that it's a difficult journey pushing towards a destination, which is nothing other than the journey itself. What is our concept of the next world? What is our vision of the next world? Our concept of the world after this is a dimension in which you exist entirely alone. Entirely alone. It's true, the Kabbalistic sources say that aloneness is comprised of husband and wife. That means in the Bashirat, in the destined marriage, a husband and wife are eternally bonded into one. Right? Husband and wife live together forever as one. It's good news for some of us, it's problematic for others. But the point is that there's this intense bond of one, but it's one being. That's only because husband and wife were one in the higher world before they were brought down to the world as separate individuals. But in this existence that we call the next world, the sensation is nothing other than what the work of life has been. It's not a place you go where they give you candy. All you experience in that world is what you have become, stripped of all the raw material. What the development that was made, the percentage increase in the raw material, is what our experience of the next world is. The Kabbalistic expression of this is that in that world, the tree and the fruit taste the same. In this world, you can't eat the tree. It's just the development that is inedible and hard and tasteless that brings the delicious fruit. In the next world, you can walk up to the tree, so to speak, and eat the tree or the fruit. You see, the meaning is this, that this world is a development that is tasteless and hard, that brings to a delicious fruit that is the next world. But when you get there, you realize that the tree and the fruit are the same. There's an appreciation of the fact that the ecstasy of the next world is nothing other than the effort you exerted to get there, to build yourself. Is this point clear? A very hesitant bunch, huh? That's the concept. And therefore, in the higher world, what life consists of is a difficult journey that the only possibility of thrill in this life is knowing that the activity that you're enjoying now, which passes and passes and passes, extracted from those moments that will never come again, yeah, through the medium of faith, what we call emunah, is built in eternity. How can you enjoy a day when it goes and goes? And the older you get, the faster it goes. When you fall asleep, you're collapsing in bed exhausted at night. The day you just experienced will never come again. What will a dying person give for one more day? All you have of the day is what you extracted. The development that you extracted, the development of the relationship that you engaged in. That lasts forever. But the time itself goes. Where's your past right now? Where's your entire past right now? Sort of a wisp of illusion, of memory. All that's real is the development that you've extracted from that, from those experiences. Our concept of the next world is only that development. And therefore the reflection of that is, every time you work for half an hour against resistance and with difficulty and you finally produce something meaningful, the ecstasy, the joy of that project and its result is nothing other than a small experience of the mystery of life itself. Let's take one more step. What's the meaning of depression? What's the cause of depression? I'm not talking here about chemical or genetic problems. I'm talking about life depression. Functional depression. The cause of depression is a life that is moving ahead with no progress. When the wheels are spinning and a day is going by and a week and a month and a year and there's no difference, there's no progress, there's no development, then the neshama feels the cold hand of death. Because joy, real simcha, real joy, is nothing other than a sense of a life moving meaningfully ahead, so that the days that have been spent and lost, the value has been extracted. But when the days and the months and the weeks are going by and no value is being extracted, so the soul feels the sensation, right? And that's why this form of depression is so agonizingly painful. It's because the soul feels, yeah, that there's a meaning here that has to be extracted. I'm not happy. What's the cure for depression? Get moving. Isn't it obvious? Get moving. How do you get moving? We have a principle in Jewish psychology called Achitzonius Ma'arez Apnimius. The externality must awaken the internality. You can't move the internal being directly. If someone's very depressed and you walk up to them and say, be happy, right? They will not be happy. They will be suicidal. That's not right. That's not it. The way you do this, you get external body moving. Take them for a run. Get them doing something with their hands. Best of all, get them doing something for somebody else. Once the external being moves, it draws the inner being. But the solution is activity, is movement. Is movement in a meaningful direction. So the cure for depression. The Hebrew word for depression, which is atzvut, is very similar to the Hebrew word atzmut, which means no movement. Being static. There's only one other option for a life that's going nowhere. There are only two resolutions. A life that shows no development. A person whose time is going by and they're not becoming a... Yeah, there's no inner development of soul. There are only two exits from that situation. One is depression and the other is worse. The other is a person who perceives it and they put their entire effort sublimated into trivial activity. The person who builds something trivial, something that has no lasting value, but it's so driven that it provides the emotion, it sells that emotion of needing the sense of purpose and driving towards purpose. This is a person who builds a beer can collection, a modern art collection, a financial empire, a political power base, it's irrelevant what. But as long as there's activity, I wake up in the morning driven with this goal, I drive all day, I collapse, yeah, I think of nothing else and I move and I drive. Such a person is more dangerous than one who's depressed. Because the person who's depressed may eventually realize that their life's going nowhere and start to move. But a person who is driven with this activity, that said, has no intrinsic value. What's the meaning of a modern art collection? I'm not talking about one that's done as investment. That makes sense. But that's one that's done for its own sake. And here we have a difference between Jews and non-Jews, incidentally. Up to now, everything we said was Jewish or non-Jews. That's universal human experience. But where Jews differ from non-Jews is that Jews take this thing seriously. When a Jewish boy builds a beer can collection, he has to have every last beer can in the world. Does that mean the difference? And then he starts a fan club and a website and he's going to do the whole thing. Because the Jewish soul knows that life's a serious business and therefore there has to be a real drive. But that's a major tragedy because the meaning of this drive is to be invested in meaning, in genuine meaning, in building of neshama, of relationship, of reality. Let's take one more step. Do you see how, are we together? A New Yorker is trained like not to respond, is that nice? I just want a slight, just perceptible nod, that's all. I just want a slightly perceptible. Let's take one more step. Where's the point of maximum ecstasy? In the journey is the pleasure of moving towards destination, but there's also the pain of the journey. In destination is a certain loss as well, a certain boredom perhaps. See, there's one moment that puts them together. That's the moment that you arrive at the destination. Not a moment before and not one moment. This is what the mystics call where the sower and the reaper meet. It's where the journey ends and you step off into the arms of the destination, where that which has been longed for is acquired. In that second, a tremendous explosion of joy. It's a combination and meshing of the emotions of journey and destination. Incidentally, you know what people do at a time like that? They mesh their emotions and their expression. When people have worked for 20 years, right, to get to see somebody that they've longed for after 20 years, and they finally are reunited in that explosion of ecstasy, what they do is they begin weeping. Isn't that peculiar? Now's the moment. 20 years you should have been crying. Now's the time for joy. They begin howling. Why is that? There's a meshing, paradoxically, of these emotions. You know, the sources say that when the Messiah arrives, when the Mashiach comes, Jewish families will sit down and begin crying. Every family will sit down and begin weeping. Why? Because throughout the exile, the only reason we survive is because we're given a heart of stone. The reason you're given an insensitive heart is because if you were sensitive to the suffering of the world, you could not continue. You could not continue. A person who had a loss in their family, a real personal and close loss, could not continue. When the Ponovitch Arov, the great rabbi who started Ponovitch, and he came out of Europe and his wife and 10 children had been killed. So when he came to Bnei Brak, he said, we're going to build the biggest yeshiva in the world here. People humored him. They thought he lost his mind because of the tragedy. But he was able to rebuild and remarry and refound a family. How do you do that? If you understood what one child had gone through 60 years ago, one child, never mind a family, never mind millions, you couldn't sleep at night. You wouldn't have sleep at night. The reason you continue is because you've given a desensitized heart. And as time goes by, you forget. It's this mechanism that enables you to survive and continue. But when the Mashiach comes, and it says, Vasirishini kemis leva evin, I will take away the heart of stone from you, and I'll give you a heart of flesh, that's when the crying will begin. When you're reinstated as a genuine human being, when we have the feelings again, the depth of feeling, that's when the weeping will begin. But the meeting of destination, of journey and destination, that's when this explosion takes place. What is the nature of that explosion? What is the nature of that emotion? We call that ptur. Ptur means a sensation of exemption, being divested of responsibility. When the push and push and push of the journey finally yields to the result, and the burden is unshouldered. You know, when someone dies, in Hebrew we say niftar. We don't say die. We say becomes exempt from obligation. Divested of obligation. That's what the word niftar means. It's a sense of freedom at the end of, when you turn the key in the place of your workplace at the end of a hard year of work. There's a tremendous surge of joy. It's the joy of the freedom. It's a peculiar thing. You just turn the key. The moment when the final school bell rings. Tremendous surge of joy. Why? Just a bell ringing. But it's transition from slavery to freedom. Right? That's the surge. The first five minutes when you hit the beach. What do you do in the first 5 minutes on the beach? Nothing. You lie there semi-conscious without moving a muscle. What's the ecstasy of that? That's the whole point. There's nowhere else to go. Anywhere else would be away. There's no movement possible then because you've arrived. This is destination. Any movement would be a movement away. Marriage also contains, there's also intimate things here which we can't go into. At Sinai, when the Jewish people stood at Sinai, we meshed into the ultimate reality. So imagine says nothing on earth moved at that moment. There was no vibration, nothing moved. Because any movement at the point of destination would be a movement away. That's the sensation of being exempt, divested of responsibility. There's no journey left. The freedom is experienced. Where is that reflected in human experience? Let me share with you three examples. There's a mitzvah that reflects it. There's an inyan issue in Torah that reflects it. And there's an issue in universal human experience. The mitzvah that represents arriving at an endpoint and experiencing the joy of freedom is called Shabbat. What is the idea of the Sabbath, of Shabbat? The idea of Shabbat is that you push for a week and you reach a crescendo of activity on Friday, Erev Shabbat, the sun goes down. The serenity of that moment is that the exertion of the week has resulted in the what we call Shabbat. Shabbat is not an activity that stands alone. It's the joy of the Shabbat is because it's consolidation and experience of what has been built during the week. Do you know that the Torah never mentions Shabbat other than it mentions 6 days of work first? The meaning of Shabbat is 6 days of push towards destination, and then there's a sense of what has been achieved. What's relished on Shabbat is what has been built that week. The experience in learning is called learning Torah Lishma. Learning Torah for its own sake, right? Well, we're a yeshiva activity. A person sits and learns Torah. Not for the purpose of knowing something in order to do, but simply for the joy of the learning itself. No ecstasy like that. Because learning Torah for its own sake where it is literally an experience of the next world. The concept of the next world is an activity that is justified entirely within itself. There's no going to any place outside of it. This is destination. It's not accidental that Shabbos is called the 60th of the world to come. Every Shabbos you experience a little taste of what it means to be in a totally pervaded with the sense of having arrived in destination. A person who sits and learns Torah with no objective other than learning itself. Tremendous sense of ecstasy. You know that the universal experience of this, you know, a beautiful example. A place of Torah learning is called a yeshiva. The word yeshiva means where you sit down. A place of sitting. That's very peculiar. We always name things in Jewish life with specific accuracy. We're meticulous about that. What has sitting got to do with the learning? First of all, you don't have to sit while you learn. In the old days, they used to stand. And furthermore, sitting is always a description of sadness in Jewish life. Mourning is done sitting. Vayeshev Yaakov. Sitting is always where there's no movement, no progress, no walking. So why on earth do we call a place of learning? Ultimate experience of, we call that a place of sitting down. You hear the problem? And the answer is because life is not for sitting, it's for moving. There's only one place you can sit here, and that's in Torah. Because that's a sensation of endpoint already. You're sitting in a vessel that is a voyage. You're sitting in a ship that is moving. You work very hard in that context. But there's a rare opportunity to feel a sensation of endpoint is within Torah. Shabbat, Torah. And finally, there's a universal human experience that reflects it. And that's called playing a game. Playing a game. We said that every experience that humans can grasp teaches about something higher. What is the concept of playing a game? I'm not talking about a game that is done in order to meet people or learn a skill. I'm talking about a purely trivial activity done for its own sake. That's a universally delicious experience. Grown people, intelligent adults, sit around a table for 3 hours, going round and round and round and backwards and forwards and up and down, and if nothing happens, nothing significant happens, a delicious experience. What's the meaning of that? Why? And the more trivial, the more enjoyable. Why do we enjoy that? The answer is because when you do an activity that's not justified by anything other than the activity itself, is a sensation of being in the next world. Of being in a place where there's no connection to work. A time out of reality. Yep. You know that the Hebrew word for game is sha'ashua. Anybody speak English here? The Hebrew word for a game is sha'ashua. It's a very unusual root. It's one of those rare Hebrew roots that are doubled roots. Sha-sha. In Hebrew, the word sha means to turn towards. Like mechaska in loy sha. Sha means to turn towards. Sha-shua means turning towards the turning towards. The word itself means a self-justified activity. This is why the Medrash says that what Hashem, what God does with His time, He plays with the Torah. Mishtasheim Torah. What other verb could you use for inscription of the source of the essence, the source of reality itself, engaging His Torah, which is His medium of essence? What other verb are you going to use other than a verb that means destination itself, purpose itself, essence itself? There's one other version of this, and that's talking nonsense. Talking nonsense. What do you call it in America? Chewing the fat, no? Shooting the breeze. People talk nonsense, in case you hadn't noticed. People get together and people can do hour after hour talking absolute nonsense. People go out for a meal and they sit down, and 3.5 hours later, the conversation ranged to the most ridiculous irrelevancy. They couldn't begin to reconstruct what they spoke about. Nothing significant was discussed or decided. It was a delicious experience. What is the sense of it? Why would grown people take 4 hours of their lives, right, in which nothing other happens than speaking garbage, as the most delicious experience? And I hate to tell you this, but men do it worse than women. When women talk nonsense to each other, if you listen carefully, you'll notice a lot of useful information being exchanged. When men talk nonsense, they talk complete garbage. Men can get together and talk about sports statistics that happened 45 years before, hour after hour after hour. Who kicked how many, whatever it was, or hit how many, completely irrelevant. Utterly useless. And delicious experience. What is telling us? Why are we constructed in such a way that when you spend hour after hour talking absolute nonsense, for a minute, you know why? Because it's time out of reality. It's a time disconnected from the exertion itself. It's a little experience of life itself, of the end point itself, destination. Let me finish with a story I think illustrates this. I have a friend who happens to be a lawyer in South Africa, in Johannesburg. He told me that he saw his kids playing Monopoly. Do you have that game here? The kids were playing, children were playing Monopoly. Later that week, on Friday afternoon, he's getting ready for shul, and he sees the kids are playing the same game. So very paternalistically, he walks over and he says, "Look, children, you obviously don't understand how to play Monopoly. You can't play the same game all week. You obviously haven't got the idea. The way you play Monopoly is, you start playing the game until somebody is bankrupt. That person is out. The rest carry on playing until somebody else is out, and eventually one person has the monopoly, and they win the game." So the children said to him, "No, Abba, you don't understand. When one of us falls out, all the others get together and we make a Jewish free loan fund." We make a gemach, we all put money into it, we re-establish the person in business, and we carry on playing. So that's Jewish education. That's Jewish education. You see, the father thought that you play the game to win. But the children realized if that happens, the game's over. That's not the point. We want to play this game to play the game. We're not looking to win and end the game. That's the concept. So what we studied this evening was the introduction to the subject of happiness. Happiness got nothing to do with going out and having a giggle and forgetting problems. If it was Hashem b'simcha, the secret is serve Hashem with joy. It doesn't say don't worry, be happy. It says, if you, it's Hashem the thing, serve Hashem with joy. If you do your duty, you do what you have to do, you work and push against resistance meaningfully, the joy will be there. It's not a mitzvah to be happy, it's a mitzvah to serve. The obligation of happiness is in the service itself. When your work, when your life is progressing towards a meaningful destination, you're learning Torah, you're performing mitzvahs, there's infinity that's been generated every day. Eternity that's been generated every day. There's tremendous joy. In the midst of suffering, it's in the most difficult moments you can extract those deepest, that deepest sense of attainment of purpose. But the face may not reflect what we call happiness. The face may be contorted with pain and exertion. But it's that exertion that's leading to the reality of who you are as an individual, what your marriage is, what your family is, the reality that you're building. That's a deep joy. It could even be an extreme circumstance, like somebody sitting on the floor in mourning. You know what the mitzvah of availus of mourning is? It's carrying the soul on its journey that can no longer carry itself. What is this mitzvah of mourning? Take an extreme example. People think mourning is psychologically healthy. That's not the idea. The Rambam, Maimonides, says that if you fail to mourn for someone from whom you're obliged to mourn, it's considered a cruelty. Because they no longer can carry themselves. They can't walk anymore in the world. And you can carry them on that journey by behaving correctly spiritually. So you carry them and you perform that mitzvah carrying that soul on its journey. How does a person who does that feel when they collapse in bed exhausted after a night after a day of that activity? They feel exhausted. But they have the deep sense of having achieved purpose. Depression is never allowed. Ein etzev ba'olam. When the Chazon Ish said that, he didn't mean there's no sadness in the world. Of course there's sadness. Etzev means depression. That hopeless, despairing, end of the road blackness that a Jew is never allowed to feel. You can weep in pain, but never experience. Because in every activity, no matter how difficult it is, no matter how great the resistance, if you're handling it correctly, you're producing eternity. So while weeping with pain, it could, even then could be, a person spiritually trained, corrected, even then could be the sense of elation, of expansion of consciousness, that is the transition from the finite to the infinite.